UFOs, are they aliens, government secret projects, the imaginings of disturbed individuals, or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters. Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you today. And there are many people these days who are new to the UFO question, who are maybe just getting interested, or maybe even people who've been interested for a few years. And one name that used to loom large, and in a way still does, is that of UFO experiencer George Adamski. And we're going back to the 50s for this. And his name has been lost a little bit. I think people think about Roswell, they think about Rendlesham Forest, they think about these other seminal cases and situations, but Adamski gets kind of shunted off to the side, I think, many times. Well, today we have someone with us, a repeat guest, who has written a new book, The Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure, Early Evidence and Answers Now Confirmed by Science, Philosophers, Activists, and the Military. And our guest is Gerard Arntzen, and we're so glad to have him with us. He is a Renaissance man. He has been a translator, an educator with his Master of Education degree from Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. He is also an author of multiple books, including this new book, The Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure. Gerard, thank you for joining us once again. A pleasure to speak with you.
Hello, Jim. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, why did you decide to do a book now on George Adamski?
In 2020, as I'm sure everyone knows, the Pentagon finally confirmed that the videos that had been leaking since 2017, videos of anomalous craft or anomalous aerial phenomena, as they prefer to call them, were authentic. These had been recorded, if I remember correctly, since 2004 on onboard cameras of U.S. Navy jets, and leaked since 2017 through the New York Times. And the shape of these things bear an eerie resemblance to craft that were photographed in 1950 by George Adamski. When I realized the resemblance, and I saw two of them together as I illustrate on the cover of my new book, I thought this is again a confirmation of the authenticity of his information and his account, despite all the efforts over the decades to deride him, to dismiss him, to discredit him. But if you put everything in a row and next to each other, all the recent confirmations from different sides, it turns out that Adamski was the real deal. To give another example, since the Pentagon admitted or confirmed the authenticity of the leaked videos, it also turned out that there was a Stanford professor. Professor Gary Nolan, who said that he was asked to analyze anomalous materials related to UAP sightings. He showed a few on a program. He said that he had much larger pieces of material as well, but couldn't show those due to national security sensitivities. And it so happened that I came across a photograph of George Adamski showing very similar small pieces of metal slag that he picked up on the first time he was invited to board a flying saucer in 1953. That was February 1953. So, there's all these things that line up, and despite many controversies, some parts of his account are well, you know, remain unexplained or perhaps difficult to accept for many people. But there is so much now that confirms his account that I thought it was worthwhile to put it in a book as a monument to this brave first contactee to speak out about his experiences.
So to that point, just backing up a little bit for people who aren't familiar, can you tell us kind of a thumbnail sketch of who Adamski was and why he's so important? You referred to some of it there, but just assume we're talking to somebody
sure.
who maybe heard the name but has no idea who he is.
Sure. It's hard to imagine that there would be people who had no idea if they're if they're interested in the UFO phenomenon. But here we go. George Adamski became known and world famous in the 1950s after he had written an account of his first contact with someone who had stepped out of a flying saucer that had landed in the California desert on November 20th, 1952. Adamski and some of his friends who resided on Palomar Mountain, California, had decided that day on a hunch, to go for a picnic in the nearby Coxcomb Mountains, park their car by the side of the road at some point, and around noon that day spotted a cigar-shaped craft that has since become known, the type of craft, as a mothership. And soon enough, they saw several flying saucers or UFOs emerge from the mothership. This mothership sighting, by the way, was also registered as special report number 14 in the Project Blue Book, by the way. One of the flying saucers, as they were known then, landed descended in the foothills nearby. Adamski went over, and his companions who stayed at the roadside saw him at one point converse with the occupant of the flying saucer who had stepped out. Before he became world famous for this contact and his description, apparently there were other people who had been contacted, notably Daniel Fry in 1950. But Adamski was the first to publicly come forward after four of the companions on that day had gone a few days later to the Phoenix Gazette in nearby Arizona, who then published the account of this otherworldly encounter in the California desert on November 24th that year. But before that, and he became famous through that, the book that included his account, Flying Saucers Have Landed, is a it's iconic book, because it also the major part contains a historical overview by Desmond Leslie, an Anglo-Irish gentleman and author, who gave the earliest historical overview of UFO sightings and experiences, going all the way back to old Vedic times in India, and the Old Testament, and all the way up to modern times, the 1950s. So those two formed Flying Saucers Have Landed. It was followed in 1955. Flying Saucers Have Landed appeared in 1953. It was an instant success. It was translated in, I believe, about seven or eight languages within the first two or three years. In total, I've managed to track down how many? I believe 12 translations. It was unique for a non-fiction book in those days. And it was followed in 1955 by an account by George Adamski of his subsequent experiences. He was invited on board flying saucers, who also took him on several trips on motherships, and flying inside. And this account was published as Inside the Spaceships in 1955. Before he became world famous through these two books, he had worked as a metaphysics teacher in Laguna Beach in the 1930s. But when he was world famous in the 1950s, and the message that he was asked to bring to the world, him and his fellow contactees in America and many other countries, to call humanity not to arms but to international cooperation in the face of nuclear annihilation. Of course, we were in the middle of the Cold War with a tangible threat of nuclear missiles pointed from the Soviet Union to the West and from the United States to the East Bloc, and people were living under psychological fear, when this message of international brotherhood and the need for international cooperation to solve our problems as one planetary race rather than competing blocks, when this began to gain publicity and public interest, I believe, that's my contention, the authorities became concerned, and that's when the disinformation campaign to discredit the contactees of the 1950s started in earnest. Of course, we'd had the cover-up of the Roswell crash and several other crashes and the denials and everything, but when this message of international cooperation urging humanity to seek international cooperation rather than nuclear confrontation began to gain traction, that's when the disinformation campaign really started.
And that's why I was going to ask you, why do you think there's such a visceral reaction and rejection of Adamski? So you think he was just hitting too close to home with the powers that be? His themes of peace were too close to the powers that be, so they decided to basically ruin his reputation?
That's what I believe, yes. Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you this. He's generally associated with alien sightings and interactions and so forth of blonde-haired, blue-eyed, kind of almost Nordic-looking creatures. And certainly, I think since Betty and Barney Hill and later, you get much different descriptions of alien grays and things like that. How do you kind of square those two? Could they be different species or different versions of ET? Could it be ET shape-shifting and presenting itself in a different way? How would you account for the great difference of how Adamski mentioned these groups and what they look like, as opposed to what we hear today?
Well, remember, George Adamski described many different types of people that he met. He called them people. Like us, space people. This was, by the way, confirmed recently. When was it? In, I believe, 2011, if I'm not mistaken, by Kirsan Ilyumsinov, the former president of the World Chess Federation, who became notorious, so to speak, for speaking openly about his contact with extraterrestrial visitors and having been invited on board their ship. And he said, they're people like us. But Adamski described many different types of people, and he was told on one of his journeys by the space people that he met that the human form is universal. You'll find it all over the universe. Trunk, four limbs, a head, two nostrils, two eyes, two ears. And even though, there may be differences in size, in color, in precise appearance, but the general form, general structure of the human kingdom, members of the human kingdom throughout the universe is the same. And even if you look at all the sometimes fanciful descriptions of people who say they have experienced what they call aliens, they all fit that description of a trunk and limbs and a head, etc. Of course, there's a factor of fear for the unknown when people encounter humans, humanoids from space.
Sure.
And that may alter their perception. I've heard of inhabitants of Mars that may that might frighten us if they would show up in their true countenance. The way they show themselves may also make a difference. Sometimes, they can appear as themselves. Sometimes they take a human form. So the human in the sense of terrestrial human, like Earth humans. And I think we have to factor in the fact that even on Earth, we see such huge differences in the human appearance, from very small to very tall, from dark and blonde and white and yellow and everything in between. We could talk about insectoids and all those kind of things, but I think it's in large part it's to do with people's perception and their state of mind at the time and how open they are, how scared they are, etc. And of course, we should not discount the fact that many such experiences have probably been staged and people given scary experiences through drug-induced or hypnosis-induced stagings to create fear and confusion.
So some of the more distressing accounts you think may be part of a greater disinformation project?
Absolutely. If just think about the fact that among the early contactees, up until the Betty and Barney Hill case, none of them anywhere in the world spoke of being abducted, having been abducted.
Mm-hmm.
Why would abductions not have happened? Why would they have waited, abducting people until, there had been this, general story coming out, and I've done the research and I've published it in my early books that all these accounts were very, very congruous in terms of what the people experienced and what they were told and the message they were asked to give to the world. Very, very similar. But none of them spoke of fear or having been abducted. And then when the disinformation campaign had started to confuse the public, then we hear the first stories of abductions. To me, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
Interesting perspective there. Now, in the book, you talk about physical evidence. What physical evidence are you talking about in the book as it relates to Adamski?
Well, I mentioned the anomalous materials that he picked up when he was first going on his first trip on board a flying saucer in February 1953. As he describes it, he had been picked up by two other occupants of the flying saucer at a hotel lobby in Los Angeles. They drove into the desert where the flying saucer was waiting, the scout craft. And just as they arrived, the pilot was emptying a crucible and explaining to Adamski that he had just finished fixing or making a new part that had broken down. And Adamski, curious as he was, picked up the pieces of slag that that were in the desert sand, mm-hmm. He sent these out to be analyzed. And the similarity, or it's not similarity, but the fact that a Stanford professor now comes out in 2021, I believe it was, saying that he was asked to analyze similar looking anomalous materials related to UFO sightings, just makes for me makes Adamski's contention that he was in possession of alien materials believable. He also, even before his first contact in 1952, he wrote to a correspondent that he was in the possession of materials that were related to UFO sighting at Maury Island in 1910. And he had been told about this particular object through someone who called himself a marine engineer from Alaska, and I believe that may well have been an extraterrestrial who was working in a ET base in Alaska there.
It strikes me that once someone's reputation is damaged publicly, it's very hard to fix that, especially when the person's not around to defend themselves, not around to say, hey, wait a minute.
Absolutely.
Do you hope that through this book, and do you think it's possible that through this book and other efforts, that Adamski's, what you would view as his rightful place in the history of this phenomena, is kind of restored and he's brought back to credibility?
I definitely do, yes. That was certainly the intention behind this book. We just talked about the images of the look of very similar looking craft, physical evidence. There are various other things that Adamski said that are now being confirmed. Just think of the fact that on his first contact, he was told that nuclear bombs, atom bombs, were the things that alerted the space people and made them were a major cause for concern. In 2010, we had the documentary and the press conference with Robert Hastings, the researcher who had found some 120 former military personnel who had all experienced the shutting down of nuclear missiles in relation to UFO sightings over their bases. So there's another similarity and confirmation. So yes, I intended this book to set Adamski's record, to restore his, to rehabilitate him in terms of credibility. And I hope, I think I provided a lot of new or recovered documentary evidence, correlated it with recent contemporary evidence.
How many contacts did Adamski have, and over how great of a time?
Oh goodness, I wouldn't know. Inside the Spaceships, that was published in 1955, I believe but I could be mistaken. I believe he said something of like 12 or 20. I'm certain there have been many contacts that he didn't write about, mm-hmm. Or speak about. But over the years, starting in 1952 until his death in 1965, he had numerous encounters, flights on spaceships to other planets, etc., etc.
Now, you talked about the space people and kind of their message that the human race needs to kind of learn to work together and not to have enemies across countries, and certainly be aware and and kind of step away from the nuclear question. What else did they have to say about us?
As I said, that we are a universal occurrence, that we are a stage in the universal evolution of consciousness. Most people see the UFO phenomenon as some kind of paranormal curiosity, and it's becoming harder, of course, to dismiss it with the Pentagon's admission of being in the possession of very clear videos. But in fact, it's proof of the universality of life and the oneness of life. Mm-hmm. We still, many of our scientists still think that life is a fortunate accident, amalgamation of chemical elements that happened on this planet and is very rare in the universe. But in fact, life doesn't depend on carbon-based forms as it does on Earth. I believe, and I present in my book evidence that even science is moving in that direction, that life may just as well exist in subtler at subtler levels of physical reality that are beyond our range of vision. You know, we have frequencies of light and sound that are beyond our range of perception. And the science says that it cannot pinpoint 90% or 96% of what they know must be there in the universe. They've made calculations of the mass of the universe, and 96% of what they know must be there, they can't find or they can't see. So there's a whole huge area where things may be going on that at present we are unable to detect. And I contend that is the reason why our probes have not found any life on Mars and Venus, the planets and other planets in our solar system, that according to many of the contactees is where their contacts hailed from.
Now, two things I'll say. It seems to me that even in the last 10 years or so, I would say I hear more and more scientists saying, well, there probably is life elsewhere because there are so many Earth-like planets and so forth. There seems to be on the kind of, I think, more open-minded side of the ledger, that kind of thought. But then on the other side, you have something like the Fermi paradox, which, if I remember correctly, says, you know, once a civilization gets to a certain point of development, by definition, it will develop the technology and the ability to destroy itself and will destroy itself. So while there may have been extraterrestrial life, the reason we've probably, in their way of stating it, not found it, even though many of us believe that they've already been here, but the reason that we've, quote, not found it through things like SETI and so forth is because they've all destroyed themselves. How would you, it just seems like, you know, before it was, oh, the distances are too vast. Now it's the Fermi paradox. So how would you answer that? You know, the idea that once a society reaches a certain level, it will, by definition, destroy itself. It sounds like the space people that you described have figured out a way around that.
Well, you know, over the course of the evolution on any planet, the planetary species may well make serious mistakes. And that is certainly what has happened on this planet, as Adamski was told, but as we also know from the what are known as the Ageless Wisdom teachings that were reintroduced to the modern world in the 19th century by Madame Blavatsky, who was also dismissed and discredited as a fraud until the report that labeled her as such was wholly retracted in 1986. And by coincidence, I'm sure, she was the first to propose the the fundamental nature of consciousness and the evolution of consciousness. In the process of the evolution of consciousness on a planet, as it evolves from the mineral kingdom, through the vegetable and the animal and the human kingdom, out of the human kingdom arises for lack of a better name, let's call the spiritual kingdom, where the members of humanity end up who transcend the strictly human stage in consciousness. Now, this is an ongoing process on any planet, anywhere in the universe. It's a universal process, life manifesting itself through the evolution of consciousness. And in that process, humanity, certainly on Earth, has made missteps and destroyed itself, destroyed its civilization. And we're now at a crucial time in our history where we need help to prevent ourselves from destroying ourselves through nuclear confrontation. And I suppose this may also have happened on other planets with their civilizations. But in general, my answer to the Fermi paradox, if I understand correctly, the Fermi paradox says there's millions and millions, billions, gazillions of planets out there. And logic dictates that life must have existed on enough of them to have sustained intelligent civilizations, spacefaring civilizations. So why haven't we found any of them yet? And my answer to that is that most of it falls outside our range of vision. And that's not a cop-out. That is just the reality. If you look at the science of it, 96% of the universe is beyond our range of perception. It also explains why UFOs have been sighted in various shapes and forms, from lights in the sky to nebulous saucer-shaped, craft-shaped clouds to actual shiny metallic objects. And they have, apart from their extreme maneuverability, they've also known to be appearing or disappearing in an instant. If you ask me, that's to do with the fact that they are able to lower the rate of vibration of their vehicles, their bodies, so as to fall within our range of vision. You know, it's not that they're not physical. It's just that their physicality is at a more subtle plane of matter above the what we know. We know the dense physical, the liquid physical, and the gaseous physical. But according to the wisdom teachings, which by the way were also taught by Adamski in the 1930s. In the wisdom teachings, we know that there are four further planes of matter above the gaseous physical, generally known as the ethers. There's four levels of etheric matter, and those are the ones that fall outside our range of vision. We can't see them. Some people have etheric vision, and they see things and then are often declared crazy by most of us who don't see the etheric planes of matter. Children, animals are known to be able to see things that most people don't see. So that is where that's the explanation, I think, that an explanation for the Fermi paradox and the fact that our probes don't find signs of life on our neighboring planets, and that the UFOs are seen in everything and anything between lights and metallic objects.
Well, it is a fascinating discussion, and really it's good to see this different treatment, because I love the fact that people can take something that has just been stated as a matter of fact that Adamski was a hoaxer or whatever the case may have been, and you've kind of given them a different perspective and they can go and read for themselves, read the Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure, Early Evidence and Answers, now confirmed by science, philosophers, activists, and the military. And we're so glad to have had Gerard Artson on the show to discuss it. Gerard, where can people find the book and more information about all your work?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity, Jim, to explain more about Adamski and why I think that he's the real deal. More about my work in general is on my website, bgapublications.nl, and my books can be found on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or any other major online bookseller.
Well, Gerard, thank you so much for joining us. Again, I hope everybody checks out the Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure. Thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you for tuning into UFO Encounters. We appreciate it, and I'm sure Gerard would agree. Keep your eye to the sky. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.